You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hey y'all, this is Mark. Welcome to episode 195. Today's episode is a discussion about the Garden District with an eye towards a different lens than maybe you've heard before. Specifically, we're going to talk, among other things, about the impact of slavery on this part of New Orleans. The last show was a discussion with Big Sam Williams, a New Orleans musician. If you missed it, go back and give it a listen. It was a really fun time, a good conversation. I think you'll enjoy it. Before we jump into today's episode, let me talk about the people that make the show possible. First up, support comes from the Historic New Orleans Collection, the city's premier history museum, located at 520 Royal Street in the heart of the French Quarter. Check out their online publication called First Draft. It's a combination blog and online exhibition space at hnoc.org/firstdraft. The Historic New Orleans Collection is currently between temporary exhibits right now while we record this in November of 2023, but be sure to check out their permanent exhibit on life in the French Quarter. It starts with an interactive timeline you can check out when you enter the lobby, and it continues through artifacts and interactive displays. It's really the showcase of their newest building, and it's a really cool exhibit. I've been through it several times. There's a lot to do with it, always more than you think it's going to be. And as always, the Historic New Orleans Collection is free. I say this all the time, but it somehow continues to fly under the radar, and it really shouldn't be missed. Go to hnoc.org/visit to plan your trip. If you own a copy of the Beyond Bourbon Street Travel Guide, and you should, you've seen the work of James Cullen of Accidental Cajun Photography. Whether it's portraits, events, weddings, or lifestyle or photojournalism, Accidental Cajun Photography provides quality and value. James also does photography instruction. He's setting up some classes and some group projects now, I think. And he sells his fine art prints at theaccidentalcajun.com. For inquiries, email James at accidentalcajun@gmail.com, and we'll put links to our partners in the show notes. And now we're going to get on to today's topics. My guests today are from Two Chicks Walking Tours. As part of their efforts to continually provide guides with new information, Christine and Karen have been doing some research that we're going to talk about today. So welcome to the show, Christine Miller and Karen Fernandez.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you both for being here. It's a rainy, which is unusual in New Orleans these days, right? We actually have some rain.
What a delight.
Yeah.
We were just doing a tour and it was hard not to be happy about the rain, and, which is not a usual situation.
And we should say it's not much rain. It's misting.
We'll take it.
Yeah. So first up, let's start with longtime listeners know all about Two Chicks Walking Tours, but you've been a guest on the show, Christine. You've been a sponsor for a long time. But let's first just tell people what Two Chicks is and what you guys are about.
So the company was started with the premise that we would take groups of people out in a much smaller format than most other companies. Mm-hmm. The city of New Orleans allows up to 28 guests with one tour guide, and we max out at 14. So New Orleans has always been a very personal, intimate experience in terms of conversation and just grooving with different people over the years, that I really felt like small groups were the way to go. And when I was but a young tour guide, when I would go out with 28 people, I felt really drained and I wasn't even sure if anybody had a good time. Mm. And I felt very spun out by the whole thing. And now when I'm done with one of our small groups and I've made eye contact with people and checked in with them during the tour and decided to spontaneously bring up a narrative because we were talking about something, it just makes me feel really great. I just really, mm-hmm. I really love it. And I think since the last time I was on the show, I mean, so much about the world has changed.
It was 2016. I looked this morning, so it was a long time ago.
Obviously, the recent COVID lockdown and the pandemic. But in addition to that, George Floyd and Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. And I think during that time, you had recommended this book, Between the World and Me, Ta-Nehisi Coates. And we've also talked about how the word is passed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the impact of different perspectives and reckoning with the topic of slavery as it relates to the Garden District has been something that I've wanted to introduce more of that content into our products, into our tour products, not just in the Garden District, but specifically since we're revisiting the Garden District, we'll focus there.
Sure. And before we get too far into the topic, we should mention that you guys do offer a Garden District tour, of course. It's probably your most popular tour, I'm guessing, but you offer other tours as well.
We do offer the Garden District tour twice a day because it is absolutely our most popular tour, but we also offer an introduction to the French Quarter, French Quarter stroll with a local, and we do a nighttime tour on the weekends only, brothels, bordellos, and ladies of the night. But we also have a lot of fun with private tours and corporate tours, whether it's a family or a corporation or a group of bachelorettes, girls getaway weekends. Like, we have a lot of fun with those because as tour guides, we like to have a lot of variety in what we do. And so it's not just the same thing day in, day out.
Sure. And you've been doing this for quite a while now. How many years have you been involved in the tour guide business?
I officially got my tour guide license December 7th, a date that will live in infamy, 2012. However, I officially became a tour guide to my friends and family when I came to Loyola. Not being from here, I became everybody's tour guide when they got here. And so I went to Loyola, and when I was at school there, my friends Angelia and Kendra came into town for Mardi Gras. So it was my job to show a couple of 20-year-olds the city. Mm-hmm. Also being a 20-year-old, I think we can all imagine how that went.
Yes.
Was that Bourbon Street?
It was Bourbon. There was a lot of Bourbon Street.
This is beyond Bourbon Street. Okay.
That's right. And so, Karen, let's talk just a little bit about you. What's your background? How did you come into this?
First of all, I should tell you that I am from New Orleans, born and raised, and have never left, actually. I've traveled quite a bit with my professional life as a city planner for several years, and still doing that, just not as much as I used to since I became a tour guide, I think about the same time as Christine in 2012, and had learned to enjoy it and somewhat living or traveling vicariously through other people that travel here. And they find it interesting with my background in city planning, because then I can talk about their cities a little bit, even if I haven't been there, in a comparison a little. So I've enjoyed it thoroughly and look forward to continuing to do it. And then I think with my background in city planning, it helped lead to this effort, Christine's mission, really, that we delve further into the Garden District and mm-hmm. other neighborhoods like the French Quarter, where we also do tours there. But to learn a little more, to refresh it, to learn more about the historic background and how the Garden District came to be, and specifically with slavery.
Sure. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit first. I think probably most of our listeners know of the Garden District, but let's just give them a quick 30,000-foot view of the Garden District. What is the Garden District? Where is it located geographically in the city of New Orleans?
Well, geographically, I guess you could say it is about a 10-minute Uber ride from the French Quarter.
Fair.
That puts it right in perspective, I realize. But it's a neighborhood that is about 14 by 7 blocks.
Okay.
And built during the antebellum years, those years leading up to the Civil War, where New Orleans and the French Quarter in particular is busting at the seams and the port facility is taking off. Everything outside of the French Quarter, even the Garden District, had been a sugar plantation. And then we learned how to commercially granulate sugar. The cotton gin is invented. So it grew and developed primarily from merchants and brokers and factors in that sugar, cotton, tobacco. And they were building massively large homes.
Mm-hmm. In some respects, it's almost like a master planned community because of the way it was laid out, I think. Is that fair, or would you disagree with that?
I wouldn't say it's unfair. But it's one in which the way it grew, the plantations all lined the Mississippi River.
Mm-hmm.
That was the main transportation before railroads come in. But nevertheless, if you look at the Garden District today, it is about 11 blocks away from the river.
Mm-hmm.
So that little island they created between what is known as Magazine Street and just on the other side of St. Charles Avenue, and from Josephine Street, where we sit today, 14 blocks away, an island of wealth. Mm-hmm. It was built as one of the wealthiest neighborhoods in the city. It remains one of the wealthiest neighborhoods in the city. And that's in terms of its real estate value, in terms of its income levels. And then between Magazine Street and the river, that 10 blocks becomes known as the Irish Channel neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of Irish and German immigrants are settling there. And the way I think of it, yes, it's planned, and they kind of knew they wanted to be away from that river. Those docks and stockyards and slaughterhouses didn't want to have anything to do with that, okay? So it's one of the most prestigious neighborhoods, yes, but we're so fortunate here in the city to have so much intact in such a small area still today. And other neighborhoods as well, but it's one of the very few in the country that is the national landmark status.
Right, the whole neighborhood. Quarter,
the whole neighborhood. So where you can have landmark properties, it is the whole neighborhood that is landmark.
Sure, and you see plaques on many, many of the houses, or the wrought iron fences out front. And you have a map, actually, that that highlights most of those, I think, if not all of them, right?
Well, with Two Chicks Walking Tours, we're not, number one, I guess, scripted, I should say, most importantly.
Right.
But there are must-see homes in the footprint of the tour.
Mm-hmm.
Other homes that appeal, you know, to tour guides to talk a little more about this home versus that home. But it's not that we have to stop at every single house that you, Mark, see on this map here, which has about 22 different houses.
Right.
We don't do that many.
Right.
Let's just get that out there.
I think we had this conversation the other night when we all met. I think I do about 6 to 8.
Mm-hmm.
How many do you do?
I do something, usually about 8. You know, depending on how fast the group moves. And the
sure,
fact that we do
interests.
Keep smaller groups, the interest. There are some groups that are so engaging, you find yourself that 30 minutes into the tour, you haven't made it a block away.
Right,
and
you're, right.
We have a lot of ground to cover, you know. But the more you can engage people, and that's the beauty of having smaller groups and making eye contact and remembering their names, you know, it's that much more important that they take away. We want them to understand how this neighborhood evolved.
Sure. So that's a good segue. Let's talk about how the neighborhood evolved and also where we bring slavery into that discussion.
I guess I'll jump in here. So how it comes into conversation is if the starting point is the Louisiana Purchase, then we go to quote-unquote, becoming American, the international ban on chattel slavery, the evolution of the steamboat engine, the migration of slaves from the Upper South to the Lower South, cotton and sugar, of course, being primary conversations. But the neighborhood, the Garden District, established in 1830, and with that ramp up to the Civil War. Being from New York, the lessons that I learned about the Civil War in grade school varied from what my Southern friends would have learned. And I go by the house where Jefferson Davis died.
Right.
And there used to be a marker out in front of it that extolled the virtues of Jefferson Davis being a great American. And only in the last couple of years has that been covered up.
Yeah.
So how do we introduce it? And again, I think we have different ways of introducing it. For instance, I don't go by the Jefferson Davis house. For a few reasons, I'm going to talk about it, but I don't have to be in front of that home.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to introduce it fairly early on. I kind of set the historic context of the French Quarter being the original city, the Louisiana Purchase, and the conflicts between the Americans moving here, the conflicts over religion, because the French colony and Spanish colony, very Catholic. The Americans moving here didn't like Catholics. They learned to adapt to Mardi Gras. Let's make a point there. They did well with that. But introducing that sense of, yes, the same what Christine has said about the closing of the international slave market, but it shifting to the South. And in the sense of the folks that were building these homes, they're showing off their wealth. Did they or did they not own slaves? For the most part, several of them did. And also, I keep in mind that, or ask people to keep in mind that they were doing business with slave owners that were the plantation owners, because these were the these were the brokers in the cotton and sugar. And so even with the architects, something I want to delve into more, the architects and builders use slave labor to build them. Mm-hmm. The homeowners may also own slaves, a small number for the house slavery, urban versus, you know, plantation. But nevertheless, it was built on the backs of enslaved people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and really the whole community was, as you point out, because even if you, even if the property owner themselves didn't weren't slave owners, it's very likely that they were either the products of the commerce, so they got wealthy and were living there because of the backs of slavery, mm-hmm. or perhaps, like you said, it could be architects, it could be builders, it could be all sorts of ways that slavery would have come into play as we think about that neighborhood. You guys really went down a rabbit hole of being interested in telling the story more in depth than you did before. And in fairness, in before, it's been several years since I've been on a Two Chicks tour, you guys do talk about slavery, but you guys decided to go more into that and start to dig into that. So what was that process like?
Well, when we started regrouping after the pandemic and tours mm-hmm. and people coming here and during the pandemic, friends of mine and I that don't even live here have a little book club, and we chat. Well, Christine, though, with a couple of the tour guides, we read How the Word Is Passed. Mm-hmm. And he is from here.
Right, Clint Smith.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He is from here. And in that book, he does talk about going on a tour in the Garden District. He doesn't mm-hmm. name the company, but he said it is magnificent architecture. And he said, not once was the word slave or slavery ever mentioned. And I remember us looking at each other and said, it could have been me.
Mm.
You know, it could have been me not mentioning. So it became more significant to learn this history. It was also the matter of what the city was going through. Not that long ago, 7 years ago, when the Confederate statues were removed. I'll talk about that on the tour as well, if people want to chat about it. You know, and here we are 7 years later, still dealing with the long process. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm saying long mm-hmm. of renaming public spaces and streets that
sure.
are still connected to Confederacy.
Sure.
So that's kind of what got it for me. And in doing the research, Christine has me, she's saying, we need some type of handbook or guide or something for the Garden District so that the guides have a toolbox mm-hmm. of information.
Sure.
And then as I kept going further and further and further into the research, it kind of evolved more. Okay, but it's still, we cover all the matters of the architecture, the people that built the homes, who's living there now, maybe even a little neighborhood gossip if you're lucky. You know, so the tour we feel is well balanced with its history and culture, architecture, people, so on and so forth.
Sure.
I would say the process, again, going back to Clint Smith's book, he goes to Monticello and he goes on a slavery tour that the one day, and then he goes back at another time and he does the highlights of Monticello
mm-hmm.
the next visit. And so I went to Monticello, and one day I did the one tour, and the next day the next tour, and I was like, he's right, they're nothing alike.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it is, you could go on the highlights of Monticello and just hear a version of something that we would have said before, that slavery is bad. It's something that the nation has to, you know, reconcile with still, but not really get into the content of who were these people specifically? What were their lives like? What were they denied? And so for me, the creation of the guidebook, again, it's not a script. It's just a resource. And we're going to continue to work with our team on how that content is expressed
mm-hmm.
because nobody wants to go on a tour with a robot. But at the same time, you cannot have such a disparity of an experience of, if we say we're going to cover this core content, these messages are going to be conveyed, then we all have to know that we have the right kind of information in front of us to do that. And
mm-hmm.
I wanted to make sure that it got put in front of them and put in their hands, and it's going to be an ongoing conversation. It's not like a one and done situation by far.
Sure. So, and maybe this is a question for you, Karen. So you have this background in city planning. How did you even begin this, which starts as a conversation about, we want to enhance our tours, we want to to get more into the people behind the houses, if you will. How did you even begin to figure out where to get this information from?
I've lost count of the number of resources I've used, to be honest with you. But let me give an example of how to give correct information. And so many of the tours go to the Buckner Mansion, Henry Sullivan Buckner, who built the largest home, everyone says, in the Garden District. It is big, don't get me wrong. And it's quite famous for American Horror Story and other films there as well. But as you start to delve into it more, it's how you use the information. Because there's another house that might even be larger, depending on how you talk about it. And so it starts with what's available. And this is a matter of there's so much more available to us now in an easy-to-grasp format or easy-to-obtain and then digest further. Local websites, the NOLA assessor website, every house is listed. It was very controversial about doing that because then my neighbors can see if I'm paying more taxes than them. But hey, it's all public information now. But on that website, you can determine how large the home is. So when you're talking about the Buckner Mansion, this was a conversation with the guides. I sent them something. I said, you know, it was, how big is the Buckner Mansion? Well, it depends on how you talk about it. And so where the actual living space is maybe around 10,000 square feet. When you add everything in, yeah, it's pushing 20,000 square feet. But there's another home that probably has a little bit larger just living space in the Garden District. And it's massively big itself. But again, it's how you talk about it. So that's current information. Going back historically, I think as a tour guide, we all learned a little bit of that Garden District by way of tours have been around there, or they were promoting tours really since back in the 1950s, whether it was National Trust for Historic Preservation or architects that were doing work then, looking at that information about the homes and then going further into the research. So with more data readily available to us, it's not that you're just picking this website and saying, here it is. You've got to put a number of factors together to really discern the information.
You know? Sure.
So I went through those 22 sites and obtained as much information in terms of the size of the house, the architectural detail, the original owner, just as a little cheat sheet, if you will.
Yeah. And I should mention, you guys were nice enough to loan me some of your proprietary information that you guys have put together for your tour. And that's what we're talking about. So I'll tell you now, don't anyone ask me for a copy because I don't have a copy to give you. But I appreciate you guys letting me study it a little bit to prep for this session. But then as you started to dig deeper than that from the actual structures, you started to get into who owned slaves and stories about the individual slaves. So how did you begin to do that?
Started with a resource, a book by Frederick Starr called Southern Comfort, The Garden District of New Orleans. And he delved into it, but I went further into his resources of information and maybe say a little bit of checking. There were some discrepancies, but there's another matter of what there's so much more readily available to us with the census information dating back to that time. The slave schedules alone, how many people, what was the age bracket, you know, for some of the homeowners. And again, you don't necessarily just plug in that name. You have to delve into it. But it is, we do have more information available to us now than we have for many, many years. As a nerd, city planning nerd, when the census was first released years ago, of course, I started to look up my family, you know, and found out, hey, yeah, so dad really was born there, you know.
So I think Karen did a good synopsis there. So to be fair, this work in large part, Karen's extensive knowledge of the numerous resources is what brought that information to the forefront. What I wanted just originally that I had talked to Karen about is I wanted the baseball card version of, like, can you give me the baseball card version of, like, the house? Like, can you tell me the style, the this, the that? Because, like, if you're studying for a test, you, like, kind of want a flashcard.
Sure.
And when you're in front of a house or when you're talking to guests on a tour, you can't tell them everything. But you want to be able to say, like, if they say, when was this house built? You want to be able to say, it was built like this. You know, this is the date. This is the architect. This is, and so the the desire was for the baseball cards, which became this grid.
Yeah.
Then further still, like the 1860 census, I think was the main, one of the main resources for, I'm looking over at Karen.
It was one of the main resources, yeah, and several other books. I mean, I'm also reminded of in Clint Smith's book where he meets with Mr. Waters, Leon mm-hmm. Waters, mm-hmm. who's yeah. amazing. And they're out on the river, and of course the markers are placed out on the river before the city's 300th celebration, birthday celebration. But I love Mr. Waters saying they're doing their job. The markers are doing their job. People come by, they read it, they take pictures of it. So I think in a sense that's what we're trying to do our job mm-hmm. as tour guides, as ambassadors of the city, and tell that whole picture, you know. But going back to your question of the sources, I mean, it was everything from census, and I mentioned Starr's book, but there were other books dating back prior to that, and then even more current websites like the Historic Marker website, like the data center, you know, New Orleans Data Center for current information, and as far back as we can go there. So it was a compilation of many, many different sources, you know, and then I had some books that people should read, that we make those recommendations on our tour.
Yeah.
Sure.
You know? I think the intention was, I want to credit a couple of the historic homes. Like we have the BK House here and the Herma Grima House, and they do a great job about having lectures and products. And the Herma Grima House has the urban enslavement tour. Mm-hmm. And at the BK House, they had the slave dwelling lecture that was really kind of a eye-opener. And part of their panel discussion was this statement that was made: you have these people who can tell you where the molding came from. You have the people who can tell you what type of wood the floor is made out of, but they can tell you nothing about anything to do with any of the enslaved people. Mm. And I thought, I don't want to be that. I don't want to be that person that knows nothing, that can't answer a question. That would be terrible, you know, okay, maybe I don't know as much as I want to know now, but I can work on being better mm-hmm. and not have it be an afterthought. Because there are people who write PhDs or do architectural studies on one element. Karen actually was working on a millwork book. I mean, you could spend all day talking about one aspect of the Garden District and never touch the topic.
Sure. So you used all these resources, and were you able to sort of, here's the punchline of, were you able to get down to the names of slaves or slave, not only slave owners, but slaves themselves? Are you able to now sort of say in front of a certain house, or, you know, that this was a slaveholding family at the time that this house was, you know, back then? And
a lot of the records that she has shared in the document just have like sex and age. They
right.
don't have names. But again, this is an ongoing journey for us. But I also think to go to the topic of historical markers and plaques, and I think that they are wonderful, and I know a lot of the homeowners in the Garden District have plaques, but there is no mention, as far as I can tell, in the content that is shared via those plaques, mm-hmm. anything relative to this topic.
Sure.
And when you think of Clint Smith's book, and if you go to Monticello and you see the examples of Jefferson's vision for his place, and you see how he was able to contemplate and consider a great many theories and write and be the draftsman that he was, there was a whole network of people that were supporting his life mm-hmm. to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And there were multiple families, generations of multiple families that were a part of his life that made that life possible.
Sure.
And so when we think about even Edgar Degas and his family having a home there one of his masterworks, one of his first masterworks, is the Cotton Exchange. Mm-hmm. And so when we think of artists around the world, like Edgar Degas is going to be one of those names, one of the biggies. And yet I would say that prior to really being a tour guide in the Garden District, I never associated his family with cotton or being a slave owner.
That's interesting, right. Right,
because you associate him as an artist.
Yeah, he's an artist sort of in this sort of floating world of he's an artist, you know, like and it makes me think like what art were we denied because other people weren't allowed to pursue their creative efforts.
Sure, sure.
You know? And so anyway,
and so how, you know, in what ways as you think about, and as I hear you guys talking, and we've referred to Clint Smith's book already a bunch, and I'll put a link in the show notes to that. He talks about a topic that we covered previously on the podcast, which was the Whitney plantation and the Whitney versus other plantations, and how the Whitney is the only plantation along River Road that is solely focused on the perspective of the enslaved. I also think it's interesting in the years since Whitney has opened, they have caused a shift. I think in large part it's them that has caused a shift in how some of the other plantations choose to present slavery.
Absolutely.
You know, without 100%, a doubt.
Without a doubt.
It has changed, maybe not as far as it needs to go, but a tour at a nearby plantation is very different now than before Whitney was around. And I think that's a positive thing. And so what I hear you guys saying is much the same thing. Influences like reading Clint Smith's book, thinking about Monticello, thinking about Whitney, starts to make you think about your own jobs in terms of trying to share the city and specifically in this instance, the Garden District, and what that can look like as you start to dig deeper into it and the depth of the story you can tell. So back to your baseball card example, you can not only talk about the architect and the year that the home was built and about how big it is and what it might have looked like back then, but now you can start to incorporate, I think you and I, Christine, had even talked about in the first episode we did all those years ago, about you see the sugar kettles in front of people's homes, and they're often used as fountains today, right? Mm-hmm. Or you might see something growing in them. But they were sugar kettles used by the enslaved to process sugar. And so that's a sort of subtle, or you could easily pass it by if you aren't paying attention. A tour guide would point that out to you, that, you know, this is a sugar kettle, and hopefully use that as an avenue to have that discussion. But I wonder now that you've done this research, how much it would change the discussion even more.
Well, what you said, and you brought up Whitney Plantation. There's mm-hmm. a link in the Garden District. Mm-hmm. It's known as the Bradish Johnson House. It's part of Louise McGee School. Now, who was Bradish Johnson? A slave owner who bought that plantation, renamed it Whitney after his grandson. Through some research, I found that he did some other less than notable things. In fact, writing to President Lincoln and asking to put Louisiana back into the United States, but allow slavery to continue. So it's that, you know, mm-hmm. with the research continuing to find out some of the connections and people and so on. You know, and going back to your original comment of, you know, we could tell you that, for instance, Henry Buckner, again, the Buckner Mansion, had a total of 5 enslaved people. You know, it may be that the family number, or the family residing there may have 2 per person family members.
Sure.
Not always, okay, but
sure.
It did vary. But there's the point of it too that you tended to have more enslaved people than you did family residing in the home.
Interesting.
And they resided either in a second floor of a carriage house, which many of those no longer exist.
Right.
Or in a wing on the home that is typically a separate roof line.
Mm-hmm.
And the first floor would be for the kitchen hearth and the laundry and everything that was done to, you know, take care of the family. And then enslaved people resided on the upper floor.
Sure, sure.
So as far as names in that comment, the slave schedules do not provide names. They provide male, female, and age.
Interesting.
The sale of the plantation itself, we found a sale that included 54 enslaved people, I believe, that whether they were sold with the plantation or not is unclear. There are names there, and there's descriptions of their areas of expertise, if you will, from gardeners to brick masons to you know, various different jobs that an enslaved person may have had on the Libidey plantation.
One of the things that was sort of stunning to me when I looked at that document in your materials is there's a price next to each one.
Yes.
And that really just kind of hits home. This was part of the bill of goods, if you will, of the plantation. And as you mentioned, there's a name, there's an occupation, and there's a price.
Yes.
And the prices vary.
And the prices vary depending on the ability, the work that the person, the enslaved person, was doing. You know, and again, it's unclear that these 54 people were actually sold with the plantation.
Sure.
There's some documents I can recall that the plantation, when it was a sugar plantation, they had 100 enslaved people working the plantation. The Libidey plantation was larger than many of the ones this side of Canal Street as well. You know, so, but the names, the slave schedules of the census data does not have the name.
Sure. Because these people were considered property. So,
yes. They're,
right. I mean, that's the sort of truth that just hits you in the face as you go through this, right? That you have to kind of, I don't know, restructure your brain into this thought of people as commodities, which is just a staggering thought to sit here in 2023 and think about. But to try to go back in time and think about that, that's the way these folks were treated. And so for me, that was very stunning just to see the prices, frankly. You know, a name, maybe an age, maybe an occupation, but a price.
I think for me, like going back to the BK House, they had a lecture on Matilda's Pass. And Matilda's Pass was more or less a hall pass for an enslaved woman to go from one side of town to the other. And it kind of became, and this is just my interpretation, it became sort of the fake ID that got copied a lot, that there would be a use to kind of just get away and kind of use this pass, but be hidden in plain sight. And so now for me, as I travel from the Garden District to the French Quarter, and I'm aware of where these markets were, where they were expected to go, it doesn't feel like so long ago. And it doesn't feel very foreign to me, because those are streets that I drive today.
Sure.
You know, I drive it. I'm not walking it. You
right.
know, I'm not
But
usually,
it's not that far, like we were talking about.
It's not that far, and it's very familiar. And so to know that these women were having this urban enslavement experience in the very setting that I am today.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me, and there's such an effort to preserve the houses so that they look very much the same.
Sure.
So again, it's not different. It's like time hasn't even passed.
Right. There's a whole, because it's a historic neighborhood, right? There's a whole process that you have to go through, and from paint color to anything more than paint color, right?
That's so funny that you said paint color, because there's a historic paint color palette, and I went and got copies of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I would always say, like, there's a historic paint color palette, not in the Garden District. They encourage.
Really?
They strongly suggest. Mm. But it is not a requirement. And so in terms of learning, I am still learning. And Karen, when we were doing this document, she was like, not the pink color. And I was like, what?
That's amazing.
I've been saying it wrong.
Well, within the regulations of the Historic District Landmarks Commission, who oversees that aspect of 21 different neighborhoods, the Garden District's only one, it's only the French Quarter that you actually have to adhere to a pink color. Mm. Now, let me rephrase or say it a little bit stronger. HDLC, that Historic District Landmarks Commission, they will strongly encourage particular colors from that paint palette, but they can't force it. The regulations, so within that effort of preservation, also something that we talk about on the tour, you're not going to get a permit to tear down one of these historic homes, you know, unless it's more than 50% damaged by fire, tornado, hurricane, unfortunately. Then you're building new, they can't force you to duplicate one of the older homes. But what they're looking for are elements of the homes from that time period when they were built. The very high ceilings, the galleries, the lacy ironwork, the wind doors, as we call them. You know, they go from floor to ceiling and so on.
Right.
All that was done because you were living in a climate without air conditioning and or Netflix.
Right, right. And you were a little bit closer to the river than you are now as well. So that those breezes would have been even stronger and benefited from having those big walk-through windows.
What I can appreciate on the tour when it, I don't push my city planning thing, but if I get a window, I'm not pushing it, but, oh, sure, we can talk about that. And then if I tell people I'm a city planner, there's a little more legitimacy to it. I'm not making this up, you know. But what we have in the Garden District right now is an example of a brand new house, less than 5 years old. We have an example of an addition on a home that was rather controversial, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how they maintain the homes and so on. So, mm-hmm. so even that comes into play in our tour, in that holistic matter of how do you present this neighborhood and even as it is today.
Sure. Well, one of the reasons I wanted to have the two of you on is this idea that how we look at things is ever evolving. So here you guys are, you run one of the prominent tour companies in the city, one of the highest rated tour companies. Whether you're a tour guide or you are someone who happens to just go through the Garden District every day like I do to pick up my kids from school, how our viewpoint evolves. And that was one of the things when, Christine, you shared with me the idea that Karen was working on this project that really interested me, because it's this evolution of how we look at the places where we are all the time. And how, therefore, you, as tour guides, you're sharing that with people. That might be the only tour somebody ever takes of the Garden District. And so what they hear from you is going to be what they repeat, or what they know, what they share with their family and their own experiences, right? And I just wondered, as you were going through this, how much that has sort of weighed on you, this idea of trying to get the story even more right, if you will.
I think it weighed on us a lot. And as much as I certainly do my best every day, and I know everybody on the team does their best every day, and we certainly like having fans and supporters of the company. There are incredible tour companies. We were mentioning Leon Waters mm-hmm. earlier, and Malik with No Nola Tours, and Denise Augustine with Our Sacred Stories. While I don't see them in the Garden District, they're in different neighborhoods and they have a perspective and a different lived experience from mine. And so I just wanted to kind of put that out there that, you know, when you talk to different people that have a different approach and what they're doing, again, like I like to think that I'm doing my best, but I don't necessarily think that like 100% like
I think like, that it's useful to go on different tours to get different perspectives.
Yeah.
You know, I think about Frank Perez and his tour in the French Quarter, for instance. Frank was a guest on the show, I can't remember how far back. It was about Southern decadence, actually. And I think about the perspective that he infuses, and really, he gives you a lot of his tour is the same flavor you could get from another French Quarter tour, but Frank is a gay rights activist, and so he is very much also adds that flavor of the LGBTQ plus history. That, and so you could take two tours of the French Quarter with two different people. If you took one with Frank, you're going to get some of that, plus what, there's going to be a Venn diagram, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Yes, yes.
And I think that's true of there are lots of really good operators in the city,
yeah.
And that it is worthwhile to get that different perspective sometimes. One of our friends that's no longer in New Orleans, Katrina Horning, used to do a really great tour, NOLA Architecture Tours in the Garden District. And I've been on tours with her and been on tours with you guys. And there's a Venn diagram again, but there's also slightly different perspectives. And two top-notch tour operators, and really a great way to sort of get a blend. So I guess what I'm saying here is I wanted to highlight what you guys are doing, because I think you're sort of taking the going down the Whitney-esque path.
Yes.
Here. But there are plenty of good, I think it takes sort of, maybe don't go on one garden tour. Go on one garden tour each time you come, or over time go on a couple of different tours, and you get different people's perspectives and the work that they've done to try to help you create this picture. Back to Clint Smith's book, right? It's very much about painting these pictures by getting different perspectives.
Definitely. And you've had Elizabeth Pierce on the show, mm-hmm. and I love Elizabeth Pierce. Mm-hmm. The way
she does her drink and learn cocktail tours.
And she's so smart. She's so funny. Like, she's just great. Like, her tour is really great. And Dylan with Dr. Gumbo. There are so many great tour operators in the city, and you know, it's an embarrassment of riches. And the thing about, like, you were mentioning Frank, like, I know Frank. I was on the phone with Frank just the other day. You know, like, we know who each other uh-huh. is. And, you know, we all really try really hard. And I think it's like a restaurant in New Orleans. Like, you have to have a pretty good restaurant, like, to stand the test of time. Because
yeah.
there's a million different options.
The average is pretty high, so the expectation is really high.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, I mean, I like to believe when it comes to that kind of thing, like restaurants in New Orleans, the average is much higher than the averages across most of the country. And so then average doesn't become good enough, right? An average restaurant doesn't last because the expectation, even in a casual place. And I think the same could be said for tours. There are lots of tour operators in the city. There are also a smaller number, but not tiny, but a smaller number that are really top-notch. And I think those are very complementary of each other. And I guess that's where I was going with that.
Yeah. I just was told myself, you know, like you like wake up every day and you like do your best and you try your best, and then you like read all these books and you realize, man, I like, there's so much more I don't know. There's so much more to learn. And as much as I try my best, like, and I would want all my friends and family, you know, hands down to support me, you know, no matter what. But there are going to be there's other audiences out there.
You know,
there's other people, not people looking for this kind of perspective or this kind of tour.
Well, I also think like this rabbit hole that you've gone down, Karen, and unearthing all this in part is possible because of technology and in part your interest in your own knowledge. But there are other people going down other rabbit holes as well, right? Whether it's Frank Perez and it's sort of the LGBTQ history and experience here in the city, with you guys deciding to put an emphasis more on learning about the enslaved as it relates to the Garden District. I think Sally Asher comes to mind, and she's also been a guest on the show, but a wonderful storyteller about the deceased and sort of bringing those people to life through the St. Louis cemeteries of New Orleans. I just see this is another sort of attribute, if you will, of what you guys are doing at Two Chicks. And I was really excited to hear about it. I was really excited that you guys shared with me, again, sort of your behind the scenes, pull back the curtain a little bit. Is there anything, I hate to ask, and so I'm going to give you a heads up that I'm going to do it, even though I hate to do it. I tend to not like to ask what's the most surprising things, but are there things that surprised you in doing this research that even as a city planner and as tour guides and being pretty knowledgeable about the history of the city, is there anything that sort of jumped out at you as you were doing this?
I think you alluded to it, where the only names that were ever provided were with the sale and not on the slave schedules. So we don't know who those people were. Mm. To me, that's a little shocking, you know, but I would say perhaps I shouldn't have been shocked. Mm. You know,
sure.
You know, as someone that does the brothels bordellos tour, there's a plug as well. I'm constantly waiting for people to be shocked, and they're like, "No, it's not shocking." No, but learning more, and the quest to learn more, and with our tours, you know, while with this research is centered on this, there's still so much more that we bring out in our tours.
Yes.
And with some humor as well. This is not humorous, the slavery aspect, but with humor as well. From who's responsible for maintaining the sidewalks? And my kind reply is typically that I say, obviously no one, huh? You know, to break the...
Sure. Yeah. And
But I didn't mean to make humor out of anything. But
no, of course.
You want a tour to be fun. You want people to be engaged. That's our goal. And we want them to walk away understanding more the big picture of everything. They are beautiful homes. They absolutely are. It's a neighborhood that... the homeowners want to maintain that status of historic preservation. Mm-hmm. And yes, there are plaques going out on some of the homes. They don't quite mention this, but that's their home that they're just talking
they're
about
being,
on that plaque.
They're being
I'm
excellent,
not judging.
Yeah, they're being stewards of history and maintaining this architectural outside museum.
Sure.
You know,
and they work hard to maintain it.
Mm-hmm.
And they do. They're one of my clients. Full disclosure.
There's, when you walk through just in the last week, because, you know, we just had that heat dome over us for so long. It was so hot. And then the threat of the salt water situation, like we finally have a couple of breaths of fresh air here and everybody's outside. Like finally the contractors can get into the projects. There's massive projects going on throughout the Garden District. There's a lot of investment going on, and you know, we're grateful for it, because it's only through their continued goodwill towards these homes that we'll have them to share, and that we'll be able to have these complex conversations.
Sure. I mean, that's a great point that, we've spent a lot of this discussion on sort of this very difficult issue, right? Just this idea of the enslaved and how they impacted the Garden District and the role that they played. But there is this sort of modern, like, people have decided to preserve and that this is worth preserving, this space, right? Now, don't get me wrong. These are beautiful homes and people are thrilled to live in them and, you know, and they're not inexpensive. They're probably the largest collection of mansions in the country or certainly one of the largest, I think. I think our point today is to say, look, Two Chicks Walking Tours is not the quote-unquote slavery tour. It's about adding this work that you've done, Karen, and you, Christine, have worked on is about adding another dimension to your tours and therefore adding another dimension to the Garden District.
Absolutely. And our guests, as I've learned, as I've shared information, and even as I've brought the document around, it seems that the world is really hungry and interested, and nobody wants a whitewashed,
sure,
sugar-coated content. They want to hear it and to say it with your whole chest and unapologetically and be able to bounce through many different topics. And like Karen said, we're going to, we might talk about American Horror Story at one moment. We might talk about Second Empire architectural details another. And, the Drake music video that was at the Opera Guild House. Like, it will be all over the place, but we're not going to not mention this.
Sure.
We're going to.
I think it's just a more complete picture.
Yes,
more
holistic.
Well, I appreciate Karen and Christine, you both taking time on a school night, if you will, and our first rainy night in a long time. But thank you both so much for being here with me tonight.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Mark. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks also to our sponsors, again, the Historic New Orleans Collection and Accidental Cajun Photography. If you got something from today's episode and you want to leave us a tip, you can do so using Venmo or PayPal. We're at Beyond Bourbon ST on both. And with that, and with a big thanks again to Christine and Karen, I'm going to turn it over to my daughters to close us out. Thank you.
New episodes are available every other Wednesday. If you're enjoying the podcast, please share it with someone else who loves New Orleans as much as you do. Until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.